Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This was weaponized partisan injustice at its worst, politicians in black robes. You had six out of the seven judges, Democrats, but you also had 12 blue states intervening against Trump.
President Trump and trade advisor Peter Navarro vow to take their tariff fight to the Supreme Court after a federal appeals court strikes down most of Trump's tariffs. We'll speak with the former Solicitor General, Neil Katyal, who argued the case, and with Oregon's Attorney General, who brought it. Then a court blocks the Trump administration from deporting as many as 700 unaccompanied Guatemalan children after a try to fly some of them out in the dead of night over Labor Day weekend. And finally, Yemen vows to retaliate after an Israeli airstrike killed the prime minister of Yemen's Houthi-run government and some 11 other senior figures. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump has vowed to take his tariff fight to the Supreme Court after a federal appeals court ruled Friday most of the tariffs imposed by the White House on nearly every other country have no legal basis. This includes the Liberation Day tariffs imposed in April, as well as earlier tariffs against Canada, Mexico, and China. The decision upholds an earlier ruling by the U.S. Court of International Trade. In its decision, the appeals court called tariffs, quote, a core congressional power. After headlines, we'll speak with the former Solicitor General, Neil Katyal, who argued the legal challenge to the tariffs, as well as Oregon's Attorney General, who brought the case. In international news, a landslide in Sudan's Darfur region killed more than 1,000 people Sunday. That's according to the Sudan Liberation Movement, an armed rebel group that controls the region. The landslide destroyed a village in the Mara Mountains, where residents had sought refuge to escape fighting between the Sudanese army and the rival paramilitary faction, the Rapid Support Forces. The Darfur region is largely inaccessible to international aid groups due to the civil war, which is now in its third year. In Afghanistan, the death toll from Sunday's earthquake in a remote mountainous area near the Pakistan border has topped 1,400 and is expected to rise, with thousands more injured by the disaster. It's one of the deadliest earthquakes to hit Afghanistan in over a decade, with aftershocks felt in neighboring Pakistan and as far away as India. Roads have been blocked and communications have been disrupted. Aid workers are forced to walk for hours to reach affected communities. Here's one of the survivors, Mohammed Ibrahim.
A total of 25 people from my family were martyred, and they're still under the rubble. I ask the international community to provide us with aid, and God will grant them rewards.
The U.S. offered its condolences on X without pledging any aid. An official from the U.N. Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan told Reuters U.S. aid cuts have hampered the response to the earthquake, saying, quote, the number of people we have on the ground is much less than we would have had 6 months ago, unquote. Meanwhile, China, India, Pakistan, Switzerland, and the United Arab Emirates have all pledged disaster relief assistance to Afghanistan. In Gaza, Israeli attacks since dawn have killed at least 54 Palestinians, including people seeking food. The attacks came as Gaza health officials recorded another 13 deaths due to starvation, three of them children. That brings the number of hunger-related deaths in Gaza to more than 360. According to a leading global monitor, more than 500,000 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are suffering catastrophic hunger due to Israel's blockade. On Monday, a steady stream of Palestinians fled northern parts of Gaza City as Israeli forces pushed deeper into the Gaza Strip's largest urban area, home to about 1 million people.
I want to find a place where I can stay with my sons and daughters. I don't know where to go. Moving out requires money. I can't even find something to eat. It has been 2 months without food. I don't know where to go. I borrowed money from here and there. No one is standing by me to give me anything. No one is standing with the Palestinian people.
On Monday, millions of Israeli students returned to their classrooms to begin the new school year. Meanwhile, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warns of a lost generation of more than 660,000 Palestinian children in Gaza, deprived of schooling for a third consecutive year. The world's leading genocide scholars association has approved a resolution establishing Israel's policies and actions in Gaza meet the legal definition of genocide as found in the Genocide Convention, constituting war crimes and crimes against humanity. Melanie O'Brien's president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars.
This resolution declaring what is happening in Gaza as genocide passed by an overwhelming majority, far beyond the two-thirds majority required.
This comes after hundreds of staffers at the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights signed a letter urging the UN agency to declare Israel's assault on Gaza a genocide and calling on UN member states to suspend arms sales to Israel. In Spain, dozens of ships carrying civilian activists and loaded with humanitarian aid departed Barcelona Monday, bound for the Gaza Strip. The Global Samud Flotilla is the largest attempt yet to challenge Israel's blockade of Gaza. Swedish activists Greta Thunberg helped to organize the flotilla.
Israel are very clear about their genocidal intent. They want to erase the Palestinian nation. They want to take over the Gaza Strip. And if that doesn't make people act, if that doesn't make people go out of their couch and take action, fill the streets, get organized, then I don't know what will.
In Australia, peace activists hold a nonviolent protest blocking the entrance of Port Melbourne, demanding Australia suspend trade with Israel. Meanwhile, in Colorado, dozens of Jewish peace activists and allies rallied Friday outside the Denver office of Senator Michael Bennet. Protesters are calling on him and Colorado's other Democratic Senator John Hickenlooper to join 27 other Senate Democrats and independents who voted in support of a resolution to block arms transfers to Israel. In Yemen, thousands of mourners gathered at the largest mosque in the capital Sana'a on Monday for the funerals of the prime minister of Yemen's Houthi-run government, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and 11 other Houthi leaders. Also killed in Thursday's attack was Houthi's defense minister. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast with the Palestinian-American scholar Rami Khoudi. The Trump administration tried to deport over 600 unaccompanied Guatemalan children over Labor Day weekend, but a federal judge temporarily halted their removal, ruling the actions unlawful. The National Immigration Law Center filed an emergency request to stop the deportation flight, saying the children face abuse, neglect, persecution, or torture if deported to Guatemala. As the children were loaded onto planes in Texas and waiting on the tarmac, U.S. District Judge Sparkle Sutnanan was woken at 2:35 a.m. to address the case. The judge later issued a 14-day restraining order allowing the children to stay in the U.S. for now to challenge their removal. We'll go to McAllen, Texas, to speak with a lawyer arguing on behalf of the children later in the broadcast. In Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott has signed a new congressional map into law, which is aimed at giving Republicans 5 more seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. In response, Indivisible's National Advocacy Director Andrew O'Neill said, quote, Governor Abbott's mid-decade redistricting effort is anti-democratic and discriminatory. He's not just rigging the maps in Texas. He's attempting to undermine the midterm elections and diluting the power and voice of communities of color in Texas while doing so, unquote. Meanwhile, in Utah, a judge tossed out the state's current congressional map and ordered the Republican-led state legislature to draw a new one by September 24th. The move could favor Democrats as the party could pick up a seat in Salt Lake City. Chinese President Xi Jinping welcomed leaders of Asian nations to Tianjin for the regional summit on Sunday, warmly greeting Russian President Vladimir Putin and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi as friends and opposing what he called the bullying and Cold War mentality of the United States under President Trump. It was the first visit by Prime Minister Modi to China in 7 years, signaling a thaw in relations between India and China. In a joint statement following the talks, members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization strongly condemned recent U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iran. The group made no mention of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Meanwhile, the European Commission says a plane carrying European Union chief Ursula von der Leyen was left circling above an airport in southern Bulgaria Sunday after an apparent GPS jamming attack on the plane. According to the Financial Times, the plane's pilots were forced to land using paper maps. The European Commission blamed Russia for jamming the plane's navigation system and said the incident would, quote, ramp up our defense capabilities and support for Ukraine, unquote. In Indonesia, at least 7 people are dead, hundreds more injured amidst a crackdown on anti-government protests that erupted in Jakarta a week ago before spreading across Indonesia. The uprising began with protests outside Indonesia's parliament against salaries and housing allowances for lawmakers that are nearly 10 times the minimum wage in Jakarta. Protests spread nationwide after footage showed a paramilitary police unit using an armored vehicle to ram a group of protesters, killing a 21-year-old delivery driver. Protesters have since burned or ransacked buses, subways, and the homes of several prominent politicians. And more than 1,000 demonstrations were held across the United States Monday for Labor Day as protesters came out against what the AFL-CIA called a, quote, government by and for the CEOs and billionaires, unquote. The protests come after President Trump stripped nearly 500,000 federal workers of their union protections in August. On New York's Long Island, workers, community organizers and climate activists marched through the streets of the Hamptons to expose billionaires. Their donors who are bankrolling the mayoral campaigns of Governor Andrew Cuomo and Mayor Eric Adams. Meanwhile, in Chicago, labor leaders joined Mayor Brandon Johnson to denounce Trump's threats to blanket Chicago with National Guard troops and federal immigration agents. Stacey Davis Gates is president of the Chicago Teachers Union.
In Chicago right now, we are reconstructing school libraries so we can teach the truth and media literacy. In Chicago, we are reopening mental health clinics, abolishing sub-minimum wage, making sure that workers get paid time off. We are in a reconstruction with a black mayor whose family escaped Silas, Mississippi, and imagine his leadership. We're doing it with an organizer, not a billionaire. We are a government of the people for the people, not a government of billionaires for billionaires.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump's vow to take his tariff fight to the Supreme Court after a federal appeals court Friday struck down most of the tariffs imposed by the White House, including the Liberation Day tariffs imposed in April, as well as earlier tariffs against Canada, Mexico, and China. The decision upholds an earlier ruling by the U.S. Court of International Trade. Its ruling, the appeals court called tariffs, quote, a core congressional power. The White House argued the president can unilaterally impose tariffs based on powers granted by the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, which has historically been used to impose sanctions. But its decision, the appeals court wrote, quote, it seems unlikely Congress intended in enacting IEEPA to depart from its past practice and grant the president unlimited authority to impose tariffs. The statute neither mentions tariffs or any of its synonyms, nor has procedural safeguards that contain clear limits on the president's power to impose tariffs, unquote. The tariffs will remain in effect until October. Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, if allowed to stand, this decision would literally destroy the United States of America, unquote. The decision encompasses two different cases that challenge the tariffs, one brought by a group of U.S. states led by Oregon and the other brought by a group of businesses. In a moment, we'll speak with Dan Rayfield, the attorney general of the state of Oregon. But first to Washington, D.C., to speak with Neil Katyal. He argued the case for businesses. He was previously acting Solicitor General in the Obama administration and has argued over 50 cases before the Supreme Court. He's also a law professor at Georgetown University. Neil, welcome back to Democracy Now! You've called this decision, quote, a win for our Constitution and founders' vision of what America is. Lay out what happened, what exactly this decision means.
Yeah, I think it's a sweeping decision that, you know, unequivocally rebukes President Trump's idea that he can impose tariffs on American consumers on his own without the approval of the Congress. You know, our Constitution in Article 1, Section 8 expressly gives the power to tariff to Congress, not to the president. And so the president basically tried to do this on his own, saying, well, Congress in 1977 passed a law called IEEPA, which is about emergency economic powers, and that gives me the power to have an unlimited tariff. And as you just heard, the court just resoundedly rejected that idea. It doesn't mention the word tariffs in it, and no, Congress has never given carte blanche authority to the president to tariff the American consumer. And the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation has said that after studying President Trump's tariffs, that they are the largest increase on American consumers, the largest tax increase on American consumers since Bill Clinton in 1993. And of course, that was done through Congress. So that's simply what the opinion says. If the president really thinks these tariffs are so important, as you all just read, that the country will be destroyed without them, his choice is easy. Just go to the Congress and get them approved.
As the Congress delegated to the president, as in your reading of the law up till now?
Yeah, so they certainly didn't delegate that kind of unlimited power. When Congress gives the president power over tariffs, they always have hard and fast limits. So, for example, Section 122 of the Trade Act says the president has a temporary power to increase tariffs for 150 days by 15%. What did President Trump do? He increased tariffs 50%, 150% indefinitely. And that's the kind of coloring outside of the lines that the court found so problematic last week in its decision.
And why did the court give only 45 days for the government to go to the Supreme Court? Typically, it's not a 90-day stay.
Yeah, we were very grateful to see that the court on its own did that. And I think it's, you know, obviously, you know, they have their reasons. But my guess is it's because they recognize the importance of this issue and that it should be decided quickly. I'm privileged to represent a group of small businesses who are struggling every day to understand what these rules are, how important, how, you know, what these tariffs are likely to be. Will there be, you know, refunds on these illegal tariffs in the future? All sorts of really difficult questions. And I think the Court of Appeals did something really good by saying, look, government, normally you have 90 days to go to the Supreme Court. We're only giving you 45.
Explain overall what tariffs would be lifted. Explain how this works, this timeline, and what do you expect the Supreme Court to do?
Well, so the president has two choices right now. One is he could do what the court last week said he should do, which is to go to Congress and seek their approval. It's our hope that he will do that, and, you know, and then Congress can decide. I note that President Trump tried to get approval before when he was president the first time, and Congress said no. But, you know, that's a debate that I think the American people should have, that the American Congress should have. The other option is, of course, he could go to the U.S. Supreme Court. He could try as early as this week. And the court could hear the case pretty quickly in a matter of a month or two, and then resolve the case pretty quickly. So I think those are the paths that are available right now to the administration. But right now, these tariffs have been declared illegal and unconstitutional by the nation's second highest court.
And how do you expect the Supreme Court to rule, given the six-judge conservative majority on the court?
Well, I'm not going to predict how the court will rule. We think the case here is overwhelming, but I've heard these questions all the time in my past cases, which I've litigated in the Supreme Court. Oh, the court is too conservative or something. I'm reminded, I think I was even on this program when I argued Moore versus Harper, which was a case challenging the Republican National Committee's theory of the independent state legislature doctrine, which, if they had won that case, would have entrenched Republican rule for perhaps decades. And everyone said, oh, the Supreme Court, you know, they're in the pocket of Republicans and so on. And, you know, I never thought that was right. I thought that the Supreme Court would look at this by understanding what is the original intent of the Constitution when it comes to elections. And lo and behold, 6-3, the Supreme Court rejected that Republican theory there. I think a similar result is very possible here. Again, I'm not here to predict what the court will do, but I think if they look at, as I suspect they will, the original understanding of the Constitution, the fact that our founders cared so much about the taxation and tariff power to put it in expressly Congress's control and strip the president of any power over that, because they knew that every king and despot always wants to use the tax power. I mean, think Boston Tea Party, think so many other things in our revolutionary history. The idea that the president could come along and just impose taxes and tariffs on the American people on his own would have turned the founders over in their graves. So we are going to make that case to the Supreme Court should this become a Supreme Court case, and we are optimistic in the strength of that argument.
Neil Katyal, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Law professor at Georgetown University argued the case before the court, which has now struck down Trump's tariffs, but they can remain until October. We will, of course, continue to follow the story, as we will turn right now to Dan Rayfield, Oregon Attorney General. He's leading the multi-state lawsuit against Trump's tariffs. He's joining us from Salem, Oregon. Oregon Attorney General, thanks so much for being with us. You're the one who brought this case. Explain why you brought it and the significance of the ruling of the court.
Yeah, I think when people think about tariffs or you hear tariffs, that word in your community, you don't feel that that's something that's impacting you as a person just walking through your community. In fact, if you listen to President Trump, he claims and brags that all of these costs are being paid by foreign businesses. And the fact is that when you look at it, when you look at people that we trust, Goldman Sachs, all of these others, JP Morgan, they show that about 70-80% of those tariffs are paid by Americans. And so when you thought about the importance of this case, especially when cost of living is such a huge thing for Americans right now, and you see a president using and abusing an emergency power that had never been used for tariffs before, it was a real easy decision for us to move forward. Here in Oregon, I was hearing from businesses that were having their products removed off their shelves in Canada. We're seeing the cost of goods that the state was purchasing increasing. And it was just only the beginning when we started this journey back in February and really starting evaluating the impact. So it made absolute sense for us to get involved and say, hey, Mr. President, if you want to do tariffs, that's great. Just do them the right way. Do them the way that Congress intended.
And the first court to hear this case was the Court of International Trade in New York, where there were two Republican judges, yet the court voted unanimously against these tariffs. Well, what's your sense of how this will continue to work its way up the judicial chain here?
Yeah, and the one thing that I never got when I became Attorney General was a crystal ball, so just know that. But as you look at this, I think what people should find interesting that you have 11 judges that have all ruled that the manner in which the president has tried to implement his tariffs is unconstitutional. It went beyond the safeguards that Congress intended for consumers. They put these sideboards. Congress put sideboards in place to protect consumers, to protect all of us, to protect our businesses, our economy. coming. And the president doesn't want to use this, so he went around them. So it wasn't surprising that you had Republican or judges appointed by Republicans saying, hey, you went too far here. This isn't what Congress intended. This isn't what our Constitution intended. We had one judge in the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals that actually ruled and appointed by a Republican that ruled that these were unconstitutional as well. So I don't think that these are really Democratic or Republican leaning issues. I mean, these are foundational Democratic principles that we're trying to uphold.
I wanted to turn to the White House trade advisor, Peter Navarro, speaking about the tariffs lawsuit on Monday.
This case is arguably the single most important economic case that has ever come before the Supreme Court. If the lower court's ruling is upheld, President Trump has correctly said that will be the end of the United States. I think we're in very good shape. Bottom line is we're optimistic that the Supreme Court will rule on this. We don't have to. The tariffs will remain in place at least through October and perhaps beyond until the Supreme Court rules on this.
So that's Peter Navarro, the top trade advisor to President Trump, the convicted felon who was pardoned by Trump. Dan Rayfield, Oregon Attorney General, your response?
I would just say I wish I had the moral flexibility to make such bold, inaccurate statements to the American public the way that the Trump administration does. It's absolutely wild to sit there and say that that is going to destroy America. I would argue giving all of the power to tax, because that's what these are. These are a tax on American people, and giving all of that power to the president without the ability of Congress to curb it is more un-American than anything that is going on right now. This case is incredibly important for the American people and our autonomy and Congress's autonomy. It's wild, the things they say. But again, this is an administration that truly lives on a hyperbole and making wild statements like this. It's just factually inaccurate. And again, remember, like as we're going through the stores, you're seeing it right now. The prices for school supplies. My son goes starts school tomorrow. The prices of clothes. These things are absolutely increasing every week in our stores. Incredibly wild for them to make statements like this. And remember, and that's the other thing, if you do care about trade, if you do care about how these things are being implemented, remember that no other president has needed to do tariffs this way. Every other president has used the regular statutes. In fact, Donald Trump used the other statutes when he was implementing tariffs. It's been done before. We've entered into successful trade agreements lawfully, constitutionally, the way that the Constitution and Congress intended.
And Attorney General, you mentioned that this is these tariffs are in effect a tax, but it's also a regressive tax, isn't it? Hitting more the folks on the lower income strata of American society.
Oh, absolutely. And this is what Republicans are trying to do to us right now. On one hand, you see this big, beautiful bill, and I don't even like calling it that, where they're yanking away health care benefits from Americans. They are yanking away food assistance benefits on the one hand. And on the other hand, they are passing this hidden regressive tax that's impacting vulnerable Americans more than the wealthy. It is an entire reshaping of the American economy that is going on right now. And the wild thing that is this, they are doing it without congressional approval when it comes to these tariffs. Again, I really think we have to start calling them regressive taxes because tariffs makes it feel like foreign businesses are paying.
Dan Rayfield, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I want to ask you one unrelated question. In our next segment, we're going to be going to the border to talk about the court blocking the Trump administration from deporting some or almost 700 unaccompanied Guatemalan children. But I wanted to ask you about Oregon being a sanctuary state and what exactly that means. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek pushed back against claims from the Trump administration that Oregon's obstructing federal immigration enforcement efforts because of its sanctuary law. Can you talk about what that means for Oregon and the level of cooperation between ICE agents, these raids, and local and state authorities?
Yeah, really simply put, think in Oregon, we've had sanctuary state laws since the 80s, right? They have coexisted between seven presidential administrations, and they've coexisted peacefully. And really the idea and the spirit behind our sanctuary laws here in Oregon is that we want our local law enforcement doing the things that keep our community safe. We don't want them doing immigration, and we want people to feel safe being able to talk to public safety, local law enforcement about the things that are going on in their communities, right? That keeps us all safe. When you've got a victim of crime, we want witnesses to feel comfortable going to our courts to be able to testify to keep our communities safe. And so we've enacted these laws, and they were enacted in the 80s. And in Oregon, they were nearly unanimous. Republicans and Democrats overwhelmingly supported these policies. And so it's a relatively new thing to have the federal government come in and try and effectively force us to use state resources.